Hey, it's Francis. And this week we were thinking about the holidays, naturally, but really more about how, okay, so every year the holidays are a special time of their own, right? And honestly, this year's, it's just more about like, thank God 2020 is going to be over. But how have we made it this far? And how are we going to close this thing out? Well, we've got Ina Garten and Kristen McGlory on to talk about how they've made it through the year and how they're going to help with the holiday cooking. Here we go. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the Splendid Table from APM. Has there ever been a more universally hated year than 2020? I mean, that is not a couth way to start the holiday show, but man, I mean, it's super adorable watching my kid learn to play dreidels with her friends, and I grin like crazy when I think about what she's going to do when she sees her grandma got her a bike for Christmas. Cookie exchange is going to be great and all that, but I gotta be honest and say for the next couple of weeks, all I'm really looking forward to is closing the door on this godforsaken pale horse of a year. Okay, now that's off my chest, I also have to say, there were lots of amazing moments along the way. If you were able to stay okay this year, it's probably because all kinds of people helped each other get through it, right? Neighbors dropping off food and supplies for each other, old friends texting out of the blue just to make sure you're doing okay. And there were like the national bonding experiences, right? Like I remember when lockdowns first started happening. And, this great children's book writer, Mo Willems, started doing a live drawing class every day for millions of kids that have something to do at lunchtime. And I don't even know how many ham sandwiches I scarfed down during those 20 minutes. And this was also the year that millions of people discovered the pleasures of being an Ina Garten fan for the first time. Whether it's because they're now cooking so much and they need all the recipes, or because one day on Instagram, with a cocktail shaker the size of a football and a martini glass big enough to keep fish in, she made it completely acceptable to stir up a quart-sized cocktail and go about your day. Or at least live with that possibility. So Ina needs hardly any introduction. She is a former nuclear policy analyst at the White House. She left government to run a specialty food store called the Barefoot Contessa and eventually became one of the most enduring stars of food television, almost 20 years in the spotlight. She publishes her cookbooks with us at Clarkson Potter, and, when she would come into the office in the before times, it was like the Pope was in for a visit. It's been a while since one of those visits, though, so I wanted to check in with her to see how she's been. So, hey, Ina, it's great to talk with you.
It's great to talk to you too, Francis. Always.
Yeah, the same. But I have a burning question for you.
Uh-oh.
And that is, which came first, the giant Cosmo or the giant Cosmo glass?
Well, the glass I had for years. Somebody gave us actually two of them as kind of a joke, and they were downstairs in the basement. And before COVID, we were getting the basement ready to store, shelf goods, pantry things. And I was down there with my assistant, and I said, "Oh, just throw these out." And she said, "Don't throw them out. You never know when you might need them." And I was like, "When would I need them?" And don't you know that 2 weeks later, I decided to make a Cosmo for my Instagram. I thought, maybe I should do it with those big glasses. So the glasses came first.
So, okay, that was my question, because how do you come into possession with a quart-sized martini glass? Okay, if someone gave it to you, I think that says something. At least it doesn't say worst case scenario, which is like, oh God, everyone needs one.
They're actually really fun friends, and they're the guys who started Stonewall Kitchen. And we used to work with them. I used to work with them, and we always had a good time, and it was always fun, and we'd always have cocktails. And then one day they gave us these two enormous martini glasses.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you are a power advocate of the cocktail hour. I hope that glass lasts for more than just a single hour. But how else have you coped with 2020?
Well, it's been really quite extraordinary. And I know, I just keep reminding myself that people have it so much worse. It's just hard.
Yeah.
I think that our worlds got really small, and we had to kind of cope with what we were doing. I find myself incredibly grateful that I live with somebody I just love being with. So that's been great. And also that I can work at home. There's so many people that are out of work or can't work.
Yeah.
So even when I get cranky and upset about not being able to do the things I like to do, I just try and remind myself there are so many things that I can do. And me not being busy wouldn't be pretty. I'm really grateful that I can work on my cookbooks. I can talk to you. I can, do promotion for my book. I did videos for my TV show. I can do Instagram. There's so many things I can do. So I still get up in the morning and I go, what do I feel like doing today? And what I feel like doing is cooking. So I get to do it.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting too. Because I feel like, it's been such a roller coaster year for home cooking, like for the idea of home cooking, right? I think
it's been crazy
for a lot of folks who had never
cooked before or cooking,
just aren't used to cooking, right? Like they had to learn to cook or certainly learn to cook on a daily basis. And then for some people, they began to see it as a source of pleasure or, something that felt restorative or something that felt normal at least. But then I think 6, 7, 9 months into it, people are getting over it. I know I felt that way. I was actually really looking forward to, every day at 5 o'clock, I knew I had to shut everything off and go and cook dinner to make sure dinner was ready for the family. And especially for the first 4 months of quarantine, I was living with another family. We kind of combined families.
Yeah.
So I was cooking for 7 people every night. And I just knew that was my schedule. Like come 5 o'clock, I got to get dinner ready because there are 3 kids. And if they're not eating by 6:30, it's going to be a problem. And it just gave me a great rhythm and I really enjoyed it. And I had never in my life cooked 100 straight nights of dinner. And that's really what it's literally what
you
it turned
did
into.
Literally 100 straight nights. I guess I did too. And I did lunch and dinner. So,
I got into it. And then at some point I have to admit, I got out of it. Like I started to feel like, oh God, what do I make now? And, so how has your relationship to cooking, how's it felt through the course of the last,
Well, I remember that, we started on March 16th after my last photo shoot, actually for this book. And, I would say around the middle of May, I was in bed and I was I can't get out of bed. I'm not cooking anymore. I don't know what to do because we weren't going to restaurants. And I was cooking for my next cookbook, I was working on that. I was cooking for TV, and I was doing Instagram every day. So I had decided I was going to see what people were having problems with at home. So I started cooking every day from my pantry, from Instagram. And then I had to make lunch and dinner. I was like, I can't cook anymore. That's all I was doing was cooking. And so we made actually 2 decisions in the middle of May that changed my life. One of them is that we would do takeout, which is not just good for us, but it's also good for restaurants to really support them. And the second was that we were going to invite people to join us outside. So for the first time, we were going to start seeing people. So I set up, an area with sofas and a huge coffee table so that you didn't feel like the chairs are pushed apart. You felt like you were together, like in a living room where the coffee table is probably 5 feet square anyway. And we started inviting people for, for socially distant drinks. And then I set up a huge long table outside the barn where we would invite another couple for dinner. And that made a big difference because seeing people in person, I think it's somehow physically and psychologically really important. Even though we're 6 feet apart, we're still in the presence of somebody. And I think we found out how important that is.
I think that's right. I think about the positives of this year and even thinking beyond, so it's going to be a pretty rough winter. I think every credible source says that, and we got to be ready for that. But then, looking in the spring, maybe with vaccines, you can imagine a world after this, right? And I think the positive that I want to be able to carry through is, remembering in my bones how much I love my friends, how much time I've been able to spend with my family, and really cherishing that in the future.
Yeah, I think that's really right. totally coincidentally, but because I think it's important, I wrote about a friend of ours whose name is Jack Rowe, who's a geriatric physician. He was the head of Mount Sinai. Mm. He was the head of Aetna, and now he teaches at Columbia and Stanford. And he was talking to us one day, just randomly over dinner, about longevity and how our connections to people really determine our longevity. And he had a class at Columbia, and he said to them, there's an older man in the other room. I want you to go interview him and come back and tell me how long his life expectancy is. And he said, don't ask him about diet and don't ask him about exercise. Ask him about two things. One is, how many people has he seen in the last week? How many people is he connected with? And the second one is, what kinds of things is he interested in? Is he engaged in golf? Is he engaged in charities? I mean, these are older people who are no longer, you know, formally working. Does he play bridge? Are there things that he really cares about that he's just energized about? And that apparently is much more of a predictor of your longevity than what we traditionally think is diet and exercise.
Oh, interesting.
And I thought that was so interesting because the truth is that's why I entertain, not because of the food. I want the food to be good. That goes without saying. But when you cook, everybody shows up. And even in a pandemic, when you cook, somebody else shows up. They may be 6 feet away, but you now understand how important that physical connection is of being in the presence of somebody. And it makes you feel good. It just, I think we're much more aware of that than we ever were. And I thought it was interesting that it was just kind of karmic that I put that story in this book because it's more important than ever. And it's clearer than ever.
Yeah, we are social creatures, right? In almost a literal way.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So, speaking of connecting with people, of course, we put out the call that you were going to join us, and so many of our listeners called in with questions that they would love for you to answer. So,
oh, good. I love questions.
Yeah. Let's move into them, and we'll start because we started our conversation in this vein. We'll start with Peggy.
Hello, Ina. This is Peggy from Rocky River, Ohio. Surely you too have gotten tired of your own cooking during this pandemic. What do you do?
Well, I can't say I've gotten tired of my cooking. I've gotten tired of cooking, but yeah. I still like what I cook. And I think, just once in a while we just order out and it's, call a restaurant and go pick up dinner. And then I'm back cooking again, but I think what one thing Jeffrey and I have done during this time is instead of having for dinner like a meat and a vegetable and a starch, is we just have a bowl of one thing. Well, I'll make some pasta with some kind of tomato sauce. I'll make lentils and tomatoes, big stew. I'll make a big pot of like Italian wedding soup. We'll have like one thing. Instead of making, lamb with two side dishes, which just takes so much time.
Your cookbooks have been such an inspiration for so many people. Are there cookbooks that you love or authors that you love or that you...
Well, the cookbooks that I use a lot are mostly from specialty food stores because they're places that make home cooking for you to take home and reheat or serve at room temperature. So I find they're really relevant. So I love Sarah Chase, had a store in Nantucket called Que Sera Sera, and she has several cookbooks I love. Which other ones? Loaves and Fishes, which is a specialty food store right near me. I love my friend Anna Pump wrote many cookbooks. So those are the kinds of, just simple home cooking, but really, kind of elevated quality.
I love that.
As opposed to, I think a lot of restaurant cookbooks are so complicated, they assume you have demi-glace just sitting around waiting to use it. And nobody at home has demi-glace.
Yeah. Oh, this is my demi-glace shelf in my refrigerator. You don't have one?
I remember seeing a recipe for something that had two sheets of gelatin in it. And I thought, that person has spent way too much time in a restaurant kitchen because you can't buy a sheet of gelatin. So it was just, it needed to be road tested outside the restaurant.
That's Ina Garten, author of many cookbooks. Her latest is Modern Comfort Food. We'll be back with more conversation and your calls with Ina in just a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So we're spending time with Ina Garten, looking back on this year and tapping into her ideas for some of your cooking questions. If you have questions for us for a future show, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Let's get back to Ina and your calls. All right, let's move to Holly.
Hi, Splendid Table. My name is Holly, and I'm from Boise, Idaho. I just had a question about using a chuck roast. I typically don't buy beef because I'm a college student and it's expensive, but I got a chuck roast on sale, and I would like to know what I could do with it that's kind of out of the ordinary, maybe not something I would normally think of, maybe not just a normal pot roast or something like that. Thank you, Splendid Table. Bye.
Thanks, Holly. Ina, you've got a big chuck roast. What are you going to do with it?
I think that chuck is best cooked stewed. Mm-hmm. And so I might make something like a beef bourguignon or beef stew with it. But most of the traditional recipes for beef stew recommend that you cook it for a really long time because chuck used to be very tough cut. I found is if you take a recipe like Julia Child's beef bourguignon, it says to cook it for 4 hours. But if you cook it for 2 or 2.5 hours, it's perfectly cooked. So I would cut it up in 1 or 1.5 inch cubes and make beef bourguignon out of it. I think that would be delicious. And it'll go farther. It's more than just a chuck roast that way.
Yeah. I have a good friend. He's one of these cooks where he doesn't cook a lot, but he likes to get into like big project cooking where it takes him all day. And he made a classic bourguignon, maybe from, you know, mastering the art of French cooking or something. And it truly took him all day. Dinner was like 11:30 that night. Went out and it was spectacular.
Isn't that nice?
And I think the key for him was he actually did buy pretty nice wine for it and cooked it. You know, the key, I think, when you're braising a sort of gnarlier piece of beef like that is you cook it enough for the collagen to really melt. Mm-hmm. And that becomes so silky, like it enriches the sauce. And mm-hmm. I just love that.
Actually, in this book, I have a recipe for beef stew. And I borrowed a lot of the idea of it from beef bourguignon, which is I instead of using chuck, I used short ribs, which has that kind of like richness, and it adds so much to the sauce. And then I added a good red wine and some cognac, the way you would do for beef bourguignon. So really turned it into something special.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I have to say, and the other end of it too, like the non-special thing. So I'm working with Dave Chang on a cookbook, and I don't know if I'm allowed to like reveal this because the book isn't going to come out for like a year or whatever, but it's about his home cooking. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because he's this, you know, credited, you know, he's this really influential chef, and his home cooking is so not chefy. And it's not even like, oh, like chef cooks at home kind of, like it's really hacks and shortcuts. And he has this whole thing about, look, I used to cook in a restaurant. And now I cook at home with a kid and a wife and in-laws, and I just get dinner on the table, and I really have no time to fuss around with stuff. And so he has this whole thing about buying a chuck roast, throwing it in a Dutch oven, seasoned, you know, with salt and pepper, not searing it, not browning it, putting the lid on, throwing it in the 325 oven for like 3 hours. He's not saying that's the best way to cook it. His point is once that meat is cooked, then you take it out, and then you do stuff with it. And I think for Holly, if she's a college student and she might have like a several pound chunk of meat that she probably doesn't want to eat all at once, well, then what you can do is you can take cubes off of that and then make fried rice with it. And or you take other chunks of it and you boil it in stock with like ginger and garlic and chilies and fish sauce and sugar and put some noodles into that. So like basically you now have this piece of meat that you can take in, you know, all these other directions that's already cooked and tender and beautiful. So that's another approach I think she can take, you know? So basically it's like utility beef.
That's a really interesting idea. That's a great idea.
Yeah, season it later.
Oh, well, that's why he's David Chang. That's really innovative.
Yeah, it's it's innovative and in like the most like bootstrap bootleg way. You know, half of, if you listen to his podcast now, half of his cooking is in the microwave. Okay, let's go. Oh, this is interesting. We have a caller from Germany.
This is Shirin calling from Germany. I've been living here for about 6 years. I want to know about using special oils like avocado oil, walnut oil, almond oil in my cooking. I tend to have a few bottles around because they always look interesting when I'm at the health food store, but they end up getting used just in salad dressings or maybe like drizzled on some veggies, which is kind of boring. And I was wondering, actually the almond oil works great as a moisturizer too. I was wondering if you have any suggestions for what other uses I might put those oils to, for baking even, cooking, and maybe some other interesting oils that would be good to try. Thank you so much. Sending lots of good wishes. Stay healthy. Take care. Bye from Bavaria.
So Anna, when you had your store, did you carry like all these different oils?
We did, but I have to say I have no idea what to do with avocado oil or almond oil. I mean, I use basically olive oil, canola oil, and maybe a vegetable oil, but that's about it. How about you?
I mean, in my cooking, I'm really the same. I mean, sesame oil for
sometimes,
you know,
for sesame noodles
dishes, stuff like that. And, you know, I have to say, a lot of these oils, too, if she's in Germany, something I found from, like, Germany and Austria that's incredible is pumpkin seed oil. And I don't know if it's specific to there or the kind of pumpkin they use, but it's crazy dark forest green and has just this beautiful, beautiful flavor. It really just tastes like just the best pumpkin seeds you've ever had, but in oil form.
And would you use it on a salad? You wouldn't cook with it, though, would you?
Yeah, that's the thing. She, if Shirin is saying, you know, putting it in salad is, or on vegetables is boring, I'm like, that's the first thing I would do with them. So I'm trying to think of what else I would do. I certainly wouldn't cook with them.
You wouldn't cook with them. And my guess is you just need more salt and pepper on the salad. People think that salads don't need any seasoning, and they really do.
Mm.
So my guess is it's like the difference. You have a big pot of chicken stock and it doesn't have any salt and it has no flavor at all. But you start putting salt in it, all of a sudden you taste the chicken and the vegetables and the herbs. So my guess is that she doesn't need to change the oil. She just needs to change the seasoning.
Oh, I think that's totally right on. Yeah. And that will help bring out the other flavors so that the oil's flavor can actually like play with them a little bit too.
And it'll bring out the oil flavor as well.
Yeah. You know what I actually have done that is really quite nice is make ice cream. You know, sometimes you see olive oil ice creams and often it's just an ice cream base and you just whisk in a whole bunch of like fruity olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you freeze it, you have the flavor of the olive oil. And I've actually done that with a really nice walnut oil and it's quite lovely. I mean, you have to like keep whisking it in and tasting it, whisking it in and taste it so you make sure it's not starting to get greasy. You need a really, you know, a sort of pungent, powerfully flavored oil. If you have a light one, that doesn't really work because you start just adding so much fat before you get to the flavor that it changes the ice cream too much. But I have made a really beautiful walnut oil ice cream.
Yeah, walnut oil is tough because it's so strong that you do have to be careful. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I mean, sure. I would say like anything else, just keep playing with it. You know. And like Ina said, I would season your food a little more aggressively and make sure it tastes great. And then the oil will be another note to it instead of, you know, trying to have that carry the day. Okay, let's go to Ben.
Hey, Francis. This is Benjamin from Oakland, California. I'm an emergency physician working on the front lines. And in between shifts, I've been really delving into cocktails. Do you have any recommendations or suggestions on good cocktail pairings with dinner since we've been eating in so much? Thanks. Love the show. Bye.
Thank you, Ben, for the question. And the first thing I have to say is, I mean, this sounds like a platitude, but really, like, frontline medical workers, you know, everyone who is tasked with literally keeping us alive, I could not be more appreciative and grateful and just in awe of these people. And it's on us to do what we can to keep ourselves safe and our communities safe so they're not crushed under the weight of this. But anyway, sorry, I just had to get on that soapbox for just a moment.
I totally agree with you. I think it's just selfish to think that you can be casual about it and then end up on their watch.
Yeah. But so
cocktails.
He's coming home after a shift and he needs a cocktail with dinner.
You know, it's funny. I don't have cocktails during dinner. I usually like wine with dinner. But before dinner, in the winter particularly, I love whiskey sours. I just think they're kind of sweet and tart. And maybe it's a remembered flavor from when I was a child because my father used to drink them and he would give us the cherry. So I always have that flavor of a good whiskey sour. But it's really important that they're made with fresh juice.
Yeah, yeah. They don't have that canned, tinned flavor.
Ugh, yeah, the worst.
Yeah. I personally don't drink, so I'm not a great source for this question. But I guess what I would say, thinking about pairing your cocktail with dinner, and I think the reason why most people don't do that very often is because cocktails have such intensity. They're so, you know, they're strong both in what they make you feel like, but also in flavor. And I think it's tough for food to sort of play well with something that's, you know, very aromatic, very alcoholic. But I really enjoy, this is not a cocktail. This is like basically like a barely grown up Shirley Temple, but I love bitters and soda.
Oh.
And I actually really enjoy that with food because bitterness, I think, is a taste that we don't, that we typically avoid. You know, we think of bitterness as a bad thing, and so we don't accentuate bitterness in a lot of our cooking. But I think just having a little bit of it adds a depth, adds an intrigue. So I would say maybe something that's a little lighter, but with a bit of a bitter note could be interesting for Ben to play with.
What's a little like Campari? Campari has that bitter note, but it's a good bitter note.
Yeah. All right, I know we got one more, and this is a perennial question, and this is from Katrina.
Hi, my question is, what would you suggest for a vegetarian entree that vegetarians and meat eaters would love for the holidays? My family usually relies on vegetarian lasagna, since everyone in my family loves pasta and cheese, and we can change it up a little bit each year. However, I would love some new ideas for recipes for us to try.
Well, you know what? I think you want something that's substantial and you want something that's vegetarian. So what I love is like a Parmesan polenta and then do roasted vegetables and put them on top so that you have something creamy and something that's, you have all the textures and flavors of winter in one dish. And I think it's really satisfying.
When you do your polenta, do you do the 3-hour let it sit on the stove all day thing?
Or no, I don't do anything that takes 3 hours. I'm with David Chang. No, I do regular polenta, and I either do keep it really creamy the way it is in the pot and serve it so it's like a puddle, or spread it out on a sheet pan and let it firm up, refrigerate it, and then cut it in triangles and then saute it, you know, dip it in flour and saute it in a saute pan. But for this, I would leave it creamy and then do all kinds of roasted vegetables like butternut squash and Brussels sprouts and onions and roast them all together and then serve it on top of the polenta. I think that'd be really good.
I love that.
Good dish.
Yeah, you get so many different textures. Like, if you get the squash, you have like a different kind of softness to go with the polenta, but then with the Brussels sprout, I like the Brussels sprouts with a little bit of bite still.
Yeah, I do too.
I could see some pomegranate seeds on top. I could see some toasted nuts on top too, just to give you another layer.
Yes, that's great. Sounds great.
Yeah, just a little something.
Or the other thing, in modern comfort food, I have a I mean, a classic mac and cheese, but it's made with wild mushrooms. And I think I have truffle butter in it, actually. So that's taking something really sort of classic and vegetarian and really elevating it for a party, for special, you know, a special dish.
Yeah, I love that. Do you have a sense of what you're going to make for the holidays this year?
Well, I kind of love lamb. So, and rack of lamb's like the easiest thing to make in the world. So one of my favorite dishes is rack of lamb. And then I do an orzo with roasted vegetables to go with it.
Oh, cool. I love that you say rack of lamb is the easiest thing to make in the world because I live in fear of it.
Oh, do you?
It was on my station at a restaurant once, and every time I went in the oven, I was like, dear God, let me not overcook this.
It's actually, I think it's really precise. If you really cook it for, I think it's 25 minutes. Can't remember the temperature now, but in Barefoot Contessa parties, there's a precise recipe for rack of lamb. It comes out perfectly every time. And the key is, as you know from the restaurant, is letting it rest.
Yeah. Would you say 5 minutes, 10 minutes? How long do you let it?
More like 15. Yeah, 10 or 15.
Yeah, yeah.
It stays warm.
Yeah, I think people have this fear of like, oh, it's going to get cold. It's like, no.
It doesn't,
it's gonna
actually.
It's going to stay juicier.
Yeah.
It's great. All right. Well, Ina, it has been so fun to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Francis. Great to talk to you anytime.
Yeah, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too. Okay, stay safe.
You too.
Okay.
That is Ina Garten. Her latest book is Modern Comfort Food, and you can find her recipe for ultimate beef stew at splendidtable.org. We're going to take a minute break, and then...
What I'm personally craving is new things, new cooking techniques, new flavors that aren't just the things that my husband and I can like desperately throw together every night, like pasta and egg sandwiches, and are the ruts that we get into. So one of the things that I've been super excited about lately is Laura Lee's crispy soy and ginger roast potatoes.
That's Kristen McGlory from Food 52. She's got some of her favorite recipes of 2020. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So we are going from one of the most prolific cookbook authors of our time to one of the most prolific cookbook readers of our time. Kristen McGlory is founding editor and creative director of Food 52, and for years, she's written a column called Genius Recipes, where she highlights recipes that can totally change the way you do things. Like maybe it's a super simple sauce or a technique that makes something way easier than you ever thought possible. She has found hundreds of these recipes, cooked through them, and introduced them to us. She's also the host of a new podcast called The Genius Recipe Tapes, where she talks with the creators of those recipes to get the story behind them. And of course, we wanted to have her in to talk about the recipes she's excited for this holiday season. Hey, Kristen. It's great to talk with you.
You too.
So, hey, like I know you spent your entire year, so all year round, looking for genius recipes. But I was wondering, you know, looking back at the last 12 months or even more, like what have you come across that feels like would be great for this weird holiday season? You know, like something you might like dress up for a holiday meal, or that just might be something you'd make on Thursday and be like, hey, we made it this far.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been thinking a ton, as I'm sure all of you are at Splendid Table, about what recipes our readers and listeners at Food 52 are going to be wanting to cook and eat this holiday season. And part of that, of course, is logistical considerations of maybe smaller celebrations, traveling less, shipping things more. Maybe some people want to do a big, like, go all out holiday spread, and maybe people want to do things totally different this year. There's a lot of different things at play. But then also, I'm thinking about how people are feeling at this point in the year and what we're craving. Mm. And I know that everyone's going to be a little bit different, but what I'm personally craving is new things, new cooking techniques, new flavors that aren't just the things that my husband and I can like desperately throw together every night, like pasta and egg sandwiches, and are the ruts that we get into. But also,
yeah, totally.
I don't have a lot of time or energy because I have a toddler and a full-time job and a book project. And I know that everyone is in a different situation, but I think there are some threads of that that may be true for a lot of people, that the little time that we get to ourselves that we spend in the kitchen is some of the most relaxing and restorative time that we have. So those are all the things I've been thinking about in the recipes I've been looking for right now are comfort, newness, but doability for a variety of different situations. And like you said, things that would fit in at a beautiful holiday table, but also would be good if you just want a really good dinner right now.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I've been super excited about lately is Laura Lee's crispy soy and ginger roast potatoes, which are from her new Indonesian cookbook, Coconut and Sambal. And they immediately jumped out to me because they're these golden, beautiful, crispy potatoes, which always is going to get my attention. But then she tosses them in this mix of stir-fried scallions and sliced garlic and ginger that's cut into matchsticks. So you get a ton of flavor and texture right there on top of the crispy, creamy potatoes. But then right before serving, she douses them in a soy vinegar dressing, which is literally just soy sauce and vinegar. And so I had to know if the potatoes really held up under that dressing or if they would go soggy. And it turns out because of the technique she uses, they stay incredibly crispy and they're so delicious.
Oh, cool. Wait, what's the technique?
So she originally found this technique in East Java where they deep fry the potatoes and they mix in some of the flavors that she uses here, but also some things like chicken gizzards and livers and a bean called stink bean. And the flavors are super delicious, but she really wanted her cookbook to be very cookable all over the world. And so she took away some of the ingredients that would be harder to find outside of Indonesia. And she also she took away the deep frying and modified for a roasting potato technique that's kind of a variation on the British style of roast potatoes, where they quickly boil them and then shake them up as they're sitting and steaming in the pot after they've been drained. Oh. So they get roughed up on the edges and like almost a thin layer of mashed potato forms on the outside. And then that chucked into a roasting pan where it's been preheating in the oven and there's some really hot oil that some garlic has been infusing into. And they get tossed around in that garlicky oil and roasted until they're super crisp.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. So if you like rough up the potatoes, then all that starch kind of like comes out and coats the potato, and that so you don't have to like flour the potato or coat the potato, like it sort of coats itself.
Yes.
Right. And then when you roast in the hot oven, it kind of has a crackly layer made of its own potatoey goodness.
And I think that's what makes it hold up so well with this dressing, because if you just chopped up your potatoes and stuck them in the oven, they would be crispy, but there's just still so much moisture in them. And once they sat, they would get a little soggy. This makes a crunchy layer on the outside that just kind of can't go soggy on you, or at least not while you're eating your dinner. You wouldn't want to like dress them in the morning or something, but like you really want to eat them fresh. But it holds up remarkably well. I was super impressed.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay, so let's imagine it's dinner time and it's regular weeknight dinner and you got this, like, what would you do it with?
Okay. The way that I first had them was with some fried eggs. My husband's the fried egg maker in our house, and he makes them with really crispy edges. And so the crispy edged fried egg and the runny yolk mixing with this really bright, salty, tangy dressing was pretty spectacular. I think Laura said that in Indonesia, they actually serve them just with rice. You know, carb on carb is very welcome there, she said. So the dressing and all the aromatics, mixing that with rice is also another way. I would love it with just a grilled steak or, a simple piece of fish, anything that you're going to want to kind of sneak over and dip into that dressing. But I do have to say, anything that you serve it with, the potatoes are really going to be the star. Like whatever's over on the other side of the plate.
Let them be special.
Yes. Gonna just be a supporting character.
Oh, that sounds so great. So what else are you into right now?
I found a cake that I really, really love. It's sort of like a classic squishy pumpkin bread, maybe studded with chocolate chips.
Kind
that you just want to like pull off big hunks and eat that way, or you could serve it in slices and be be proper.
I love that your first reaction to it was like, pull off a big hunk of it. I do. Like, oh, cut a slice for yourself. No. It's great to like cut it. Just pull off a hunk of it.
That's the first thing I think when I see one of those really soft pumpkin breads is I just want to pull a piece off of it because they're so soft. You know, just like a really good banana bread or a zucchini bread or something like that. But there's something about pumpkin bread that's,
sure, yeah,
you know, makes you really want to go at it. But this one comes from Nicole Rucker, and it originally was in the Angelina cookbook, but yeah, now she's at Fat and Flour Pie Shop in LA. And this one, it's like that traditional cozy pumpkin loaf, but she uses roasted kabocha squash, which gives it a really fluffy crumb and a really deep orange flavor. And she uses olive oil instead of like a neutral oil. So that brings a lot of flavor.
Cool.
And she puts a bunch of bittersweet chocolate chunks in there. And she covers it in this really delicious olive oil glaze, which I had never seen before.
Oh, what's
that?
So
it starts like a powdered sugar glaze with water, just like a pretty typical thing.
Yeah.
But then she whisks in just a few tablespoons of olive oil and they emulsify right in and make this really glossy, thick, beautiful glaze that... It's also obviously about the flavor. It's not just sweet. It's got sort of like a faint fruity savoriness too that kind of, you know, it's almost like drizzling a little bit of olive oil on your soup or your pasta to finish. You get that in the glaze.
Oh, that's cool. Does it like set up? Like
it does.
Like crackly like a normal glaze was? Like a normal glaze
was? I would say it's not quite as crackly, but it does set up firm. So it doesn't shatter in the same way. But it does, it sets up firm. So you could, I think, probably once it's set up, you know, you got to give it time to not be sticky, which is challenging. But once it's set up, it's actually very, very durable. I was shocked to realize that I was eating this cake, you know, because I had to make a few for a video shoot. And so I was still eating this cake maybe over a week later, and it still was just as soft. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it's because of a number of things. It's the kabocha is less watery than like a canned pumpkin or pureed butternut squash. So more moisture would make a cake that is more likely to have more gluten and could be a little bit less tender. It could be a little bit tougher. But having this drier squash plus olive oil, any olive oil-based cake is going to keep much longer than a butter-based cake because the oil protects the flour from... Mm-hmm. Connecting and forming gluten. Too much gluten will eventually squeeze out moisture and make a cake dry. But this thing, between the oil and the squash, holds up remarkably well. So I have been cutting it into slices and dropping it off at neighbors' doorsteps.
When
friends have come over and we've sat in the backyard, I just kind of like set the platter in between us when we're trying to keep our distance. So it works really well for that. I think it would even ship really well.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if you've been eating it a week later, that sounds like a great candidate to pack up and ship to someone as a gift.
It's shocking. I was pretty stunned at how delicious it still was that much into the game.
That's awesome. What's another of your picks for the year?
Sure. You know, a favorite for me for every holiday season is Toro Bravo's radicchio salad with manchego vinaigrette. It was in the original Genius Recipes cookbook, and it's just such a beautiful salad. The only vegetable in it is radicchio, so you just get this bright reddish purple, beautiful color. But then what's really special about it is the dressing, which is pretty simply just some basic vinegars and oil and a little bit of honey. But their trick for making your vinaigrette taste like you used a fancy aged vinegar is that they chop up a red onion and let it soak in the vinegar for maybe an hour. And that onion infuses its flavor. It won't taste like onion. It will just taste more interesting and delicious and like a really, you know, expensive bottle of vinegar when you could just use whatever supermarket vinegar you have access to. So that dressing gets tossed with the radicchio and just a bunch of grated manchego, but I've also done it with grated parm, any like dry aged cheese grated over it. So I love making that in the holidays because it's a great thing to talk about and it's super simple. But I've also just been making it a lot as we've been, you know, staying at home this year and not going out grocery shopping as much, because the great thing about radicchio is that it keeps incredibly well, you know, compared to like a lettuce or like arugulas, all those things that just wilt in your crisper after a couple days, radicchio just really hangs on.
Yeah, it can hang there for a week and a half, 2 weeks, if you're babying it a little bit.
You can totally forget about it and be like, oh, great, I still have radicchio.
That's awesome. It'd be beautiful on a table, too, like holiday or, you know, like I said, just on a Thursday. So thanks so much, Kristen. It's great to talk with you.
So great to talk to you, too. Happy holidays, Francis.
Yeah, happy holidays. Happy end of 2020. Yeah. No, it's going to be a happy new year. I'm just like, happy end of this year. Let's call it over. Thanks so much, Kristen. Talk to you later.
Talk to you soon, Francis. Thank you.
Kristen McGlory is founding editor and creative director of Food 52, host of the podcast, The Genius Recipe Tapes, and the author of two cookbooks, Genius Recipes and Genius Desserts. You can find all the recipes she talked about at splendidtable.org. And okay, you know, I tried to get her to promise to send me a loaf of that kombucha squash cake, but I don't know, maybe it's stuck in the post office, because it's 2020. Seriously, though, I started this episode with some like weird unbridled hatred for this year, but truly I do also think every day about so many things that I'm thankful for. You know, we're healthy, we've got food, we're working. These are fundamentals that are definitely not to be taken for granted right now. And I do think a lot about how the context of this year has created in some ways special friendships and moments. Like, if you've been listening to this show, you've heard me talk about like my quarantine family, our neighbors who literally, you know, took us in and had us live with them in their cabin so our kids could have someone to play with and we'd be safe. You know, and while we were there, I got to watch my daughter play big sister to the baby we were living with. My baby's the world's biggest fan of my roasted broccoli, which is also an amazing feeling. And I got to watch my wife, who is an amazing person, an amazing professional, take time out of her work to create the most amazing activities for the kids. She turned a few apple seeds in a Ziploc bag into a greenhouse taped up in the window. She turned a cardboard box, and you know, how many cardboard boxes have you seen this year? But she turned cardboard boxes into a bus, complete with turning wheels for the kids to drive around the house, and they put bus stop signs up in the bathroom door. Coming back home to New York City, and I got to order takeout again, which did feel amazing, and it let me put some money into the businesses in my community that make this city what it is. I got to order from new businesses, from out-of-work cooks who are shopping, cooking, packing, and driving their food around town themselves. There are so many amazing businesses aching to be born right now, like Iha Brooklyn, a pastry chef creating modern Filipino desserts, or Pecking House, a young Chinese chef who's doing spicy fried chicken out of his parents' Chinese restaurant, or Seabird Bakery, or 20 Orders, or the Anti-Conquest Bread Company. I got to send orders their way with the hope that they'll be able to build beyond this moment. And, you know, if you live in New York, you can look them up or find them on Instagram. And look, I know that even after midnight on the 31st, stuff is going to be hard for a while. And what I hope for in the new year, just for me personally, is to be able to see and feel the gratitude I'm feeling right now. For my family, for my quarantine family, for Zoom, for texts out of the blue from old friends, for grocery deliveries and the people who keep working jobs that we call essential but who we treat as anything but. And for the chance to talk with all of you. And for so much more that stays good, whose goodness shines even more in the dark. So happy holidays, everyone. Happy New Year to you from all of us. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. Keep your people safe. And talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and is supported by you. Thank you to everyone who supports public radio in this time of need. we're member supported and we can't do it without you. You can listen to all our podcasts. You can find them on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we have a weekly email. Subscribe to it. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It delivers a recipe into your inbox every Wednesday. It makes dinner a little easier. Get it at splendidtable.org. The show comes together with the help of our team, Jenny Lubke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Stay safe. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.